there in TV land, I guess, now. So, okay, well, this is the a very natural talk to follow Sagato's talk, because I also will be talking about spin chains. Despite the title of this talk, you might think, well, there's the word spin chain isn't in there anywhere. Well, actually, that's mostly what I'll be talking about, but I'll be thinking about it in the mathematical language of quantum walks. Incidentally, I'm in the information physics group at UNM, and it's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And for those of you who've never visited, I recommend coming out for a visit. This is a picture taken during the annual balloon fiesta in the first week of October, and it's a sight to behold, with like almost 1,000 balloons launching every morning. It's fascinating. So come out and visit. Okay, so in Sagato's talk, he talked about quantum communication in spin chains. That was mostly what he talked about. He did spend the last 10 minutes talking about entanglement, but most of the thrust was, you know, how do you use spin chains to send information from one point of the spin chain to the other point of the spin chain? In this talk, I'd like to be a little bit more ambitious. Now that we've figured out how to do communication, let's see if we can harness the spin chain to do universal quantum computation. So, you know, it's not just communication. We want to be able to do anything you could do in quantum mechanics just with the spin chain. This is recent work we've posted on the archive just a couple of months ago. I've done with my graduate student, Brad Chase, at UNM. Okay, so before getting into my talk, actually, I'd like to start with a poll. So first of all, how many of you here are aware that some of the earliest work in quantum computing was done by Richard Feynman? So, you know, raise your hand if you're aware of this. Okay, almost everybody. Okay, how many here, people here have heard of a quantum walk before, seen or read or heard about it before? Again, almost everybody. Okay, great. How many people are aware that quantum walks are universal for quantum computing? Not as many, about half. Well, it turns out that if you read the paper from Feynman in 1984, which many people are aware about but haven't actually read, I guess, you'll find out that what he proved in one of his early papers was that quantum walks are universal for quantum computing. This is a very old result. It wasn't expressed in that language, of course. Of course, the language, you know, the phrase quantum walk came much later. In fact, in Feynman's day, he was just interested in showing whether or not you could use the quantum walk to simulate reversible classical computing, not just, you know, quantum computing. But it turns out that once David Deutsch's model of quantum networks came along, that the proof is just obviously the same, what you would use to prove that quantum walks are universal for quantum computing. So quantum walks are sort of, you know, a stripped down version of a quantum computer. It's got no memory, right? I mean, the evolution at every step is independent of the, you know, only depends on what your state is at that time, not on the previous history. So it's not obvious that you could build a universal quantum computer this way. It seems like it doesn't have enough memory to remember what's going on, but you can do it. So given that there's such an old result here, don't worry, I'm going to review this solution since a number of you haven't seen it. What is our work then in this field? Well, what we show is that, yes, quantum walks are universal, but we can actually achieve it by a quantum walk that acts on a spin chain of 8-state systems. So Feynman's solution was a quantum walk formally, but it acted on this really horrendous, you try to imagine actually building a device that would implement his walk, it would just be horrific. And that's why people haven't really pursued this is a sort of a viable architecture for quantum computers. But, you know, by reducing it to a quantum walk on just a chain of 8-state spins, maybe we can imagine building computers this way. What?
Kobe.
Yeah. Kobe? Yeah, so, well, you know, this is universal, you know, quantum. So, you know, I was looking for a picture of the universe, and I thought, well, you know, let's look at the background radiation, you know? I mean, that's, look up. You know, universal coordinates, there it is.
You know, he thought was doing quantum walk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's on, well, I don't know. I guess quantum field theorists would say the Hamiltonian is zero for the universe, so. Anyway, okay. So, why would we want to build a computer this way? What's the motivation for this other than, you know, we can maybe? Well, the reason is that it's so easy to use. So it might be a little difficult to construct a spin chain computer to begin with, so maybe you need to be Professor Frink here to do it. Because what you need to do is to take some other model of universal quantum computing, like let's say the circuit model, and map it onto a time-independent Hamiltonian, so meaning that you would have to spend some effort tuning the interactions between these spins and the spin chain to represent the computation. But once you do that hard work, using the computer is very simple. So perhaps you tune the interactions to factor 10-digit numbers or something like this. Then your user, you know, Homer Simpson here, for example, All he has to do is to prepare a 10-digit number for the input, so he initializes the spins to represent the number that he's interested in. He waits. The thing evolves by a time-independent Hamiltonian. And then he measures the spin state, and that's the answer to his problem. It's factored the number. So, you know, Dan Brown said that, you know, in measurement-based computing, it's one of the simplest models. You don't have to do, you know, the only active computational element is, you know, a classical computer that just is choosing this measurement pattern. You only need parity L. Well, here, you only need, you know, Homer Simpson. You don't need anything, right? He doesn't have to. There are no active computational elements external to the computer itself during the processing of the algorithm. So this is as simple as you can get for the user, right? This is very user-friendly. Yes?
Now the time that you need to wait becomes exponentially longer than the time that you put the parity of control?
So the time you have to wait here, in order to say that this is an efficient quantum computer, has to be polynomial in the size of the original circuit. So if the original circuit had capital T gates, then the amount of time that you would want Homer to wait would be only polynomially long in T, right? If he had to wait exponentially long, you'd say that's not an efficient model of quantum computing. I'll tell you exactly how long he'll have to wait, but it's like quadratic in T, it turns out. So yeah, so you know, from a control theory perspective, there's no need for a classical controller during the course of a computation. Okay. So I say we want to map a quantum circuit onto a spin chain, but you have to be a little bit more precise about what I mean by a quantum circuit. I'm sure everybody in the audience here is familiar with the quantum circuit model. It's, you know, very simple. It's got the four basic ingredients. You've got n qubits, n is your complexity parameter, and then you've got a set of states, gates, and measurements that you sequence together to enact your computation. But the variations of the circuit model is what you choose to sequence as a function of what you're trying to compute. So the standard circuit model is the one where every time you have a new computation you want to do, you write down a new gate sequence. You know, maybe if it's an ion trap, you've, you know, got new laser pulses that you apply to your ions or something like this. But you know, we've recently discovered that, or maybe not so recently, but we've discovered that you can also instead sequence measurements instead. You can have the gate sequence be nothing at all, actually, and the preparation sequence be something that just depends on n, but not on what you're trying to compute. And then you just choose different measurement patterns to correspond to different computations. So in some sense, measurement-based quantum computing is just an instance of the circuit model. But the one I want to talk most about today is this third option, which is the programmable circuit model, where the gate sequence and the measurement sequence, you know, just depend on n, but don't depend on what it is you're trying to compute. And you encode what it is you're trying to compute in the initial state sent into the circuit. So in other words, you can kind of think of the state that you send into a quantum circuit is conceptually divided into two pieces, a program region and a data region. And the idea is that the circuit, what it should do is it should, depending on what the state of the program region says, apply that program to the data region. So you kind of use software to run different algorithms as opposed to rewiring hardware every time you want to run a new algorithm. And the definition of universality in the standard circuit model is familiar to many here. You know, we just say that you want to be able to approximate any unitary transformation arbitrarily well. And you, in order to have a notion of efficiency, we say that, you know, you need to be able to do it in a time that's polynomial in the complexity parameter and also in the 1 over the error parameter. And the Soloveitchi-Taieb algorithm actually does even better than you could hope. It does it only polylogarithmically in 1 over the error parameter. Okay, so how do we actually do this thing that Professor Frink asked us to do? So if we want to do a simulae bara of this quantum circuit using a Hamiltonian, how are we supposed to do this? Incidentally, if you look up Dutch on Google Images, this is like one of the first things you find, actually. So I got a kick out of that. Well, in the standard, for a standard circuit that you want to simulate with a Hamiltonian, every time you had a new circuit that you wanted to simulate, you'd have to construct a new Hamiltonian. So you'd have, you know, a spin chain that's tuned to just factor 10-bit numbers, and that's it. But I want to think more broadly. You know, let's be the Bill Gates of quantum computers and build general-purpose machines that, you know, you can have on every desk. And let's try to instead have a way to map a programmable circuit to a spin chain so that if some quantum computer scientist in the future figures out a new algorithm, you don't have to build a new machine to run it. You just prepare a new input. You know, you prepare the state differently to run that algorithm. So the notion of universality and efficiency in this simulation procedure is we say that evolution by this time-independent Hamiltonian for some amount of time will be, you know, within epsilon, any epsilon that we desire of a unitary, the unitary sequence U, I guess, represented by this circuit. And we want to be able to do this in a polynomial time in N and 1 over epsilon, just as was noted earlier. That's important. Okay, so so let's think about this in this quantum walk language. So remember, our goal is to design a programmably universal, time-independent, nearest neighbor on the spin chain, Hamiltonian. Well, another name for a time-independent Hamiltonian is a continuous time quantum walk. This is quantum information lingo applied to a very old idea. Why is that valuable? It gives us new insights about how we might try to design Hamiltonians to achieve this task. So since, although this is a workshop on graphs and quantum information, we actually haven't really seen a formal exposition of quantum walks, so let me just do this briefly here. I'm just going to talk about the continuous time version of quantum walks, and the reason we make this definition here is that the dynamics generated by a time-independent Hamiltonian look very similar to the dynamics generated for a continuous time random walk. So in the quantum case, we just have the time-independent Schrodinger equation, and in the random case, this is sometimes called a master equation. In both cases, the differential equation is required to conserve the norm of the objects involved, so like a probability vector or a quantum state, use different norms in both cases. And that, of course, forces different requirements on these matrices to enforce that preservation. So in the case of quantum walks, we just require that the matrix be Hermitian. And in the random walk, we require that the sums of the rows, or you can choose columns, I guess, also, are zero. So it's a, it's a different requirement of the kinds of matrices that are involved, but this is why we call it a quantum walk. So I want to go a little bit more into detail about this understanding of time-independent Hamiltonians as quantum walks. So suppose we're given some Hamiltonian and we want to construct a graph G. So somebody gives you a Hamiltonian and you're supposed to come up with a graph that this corresponds to a walk on. How do you do this? Well, the vertices you choose for the graph are just some basis of system states of the Hamiltonian. And the edges, which are weighted generally, of the graph are just the matrix elements of that Hamiltonian and that basis. And I wanted to point this out because we'll be talking about spin chains with n spins on them. And that's sort of a line, and you might think, oh, well, the graph that the walk is happening on is an n-vertex graph. Wrong-o. Because remember, if you have n spin 1/2 particles, for example, there are 2 to the n possible classical basis states that you could have for this thing. So a quantum walk on an n-spin chain is really a walk on a 2 to the n vertex graph. So you got to remember there's sort of two different graphs going on here. There's sort of a physical graph as to how the spins are laid out, and then sort of an abstract graph in which this walk is occurring. And also, something that will be relevant later, too, is that the notion of which graph you're talking about when you specify a Hamiltonian is very dependent on the basis you choose to define it. So a very simple example is, suppose our Hamiltonian is just the Pauli sigma y operator here. Well, if we were to use the computational basis, we would have a graph that would be a directed graph with a weight minus I one direction and I the other, and these are our two states. But of course, we can diagonalize the Hamiltonian and work in the eigenbasis for this operator, in which case the Hamiltonian is diagonal, so it just has little self loops on each of these things. It looks like the sigma z operator there. And so these are two very different graphs, yet they correspond to the same Hamiltonian. So when we say a time-independent Hamiltonian is a quantum walk on a graph, we really also have to specify a basis as well to really have a notion of which graph it is we're talking about. This is something that also often gets lost in discussions of quantum walks. It's easy to forget this. And we're going to harness that later on, actually. The flip side is, suppose somebody gives you a graph and you want to construct a quantum walk on that graph. How would you do that? Well, the row and column labels of the Hamiltonian are the vertices of G, and the matrix elements are just the weights of the edges that connect the vertices. So in other words, the Hamiltonian just becomes the adjacency matrix of the graph. And you can play little games with variations. You can make it the Laplacian matrix of the graph. So Sagato talked about that in his talk, where the diagonal elements are a little bit different. But essentially, it's the adjacency matrix. So for example, if you have this three-vertex graph here with weights of pi and root 3, then the Hamiltonian you'd associate it with it would look like this. And notice that you know, this requirement that the H has to be Hermitian means that it's not possible to have a directed graph. You can, I mean, you can have directed edges this way, but you always have to have a complex conjugate weight directed in the other direction in order for it to be a quantum walk. So I guess a major challenge in quantum information theory is, you know, what's the right way to define a directed quantum walk? Is there a reasonable notion to do that? And there's been some work on that. But for us today, let's just talk about undirected quantum walks. Okay, so what did Feynman say? Feynman showed us that he had a way of building a continuous time quantum walk computer. And I said 1984. I had that little Mac logo. I guess that's when they came about. So I don't know. He was maybe our big brother back then. It was a talk that he gave in 1984, but the paper that everybody cites for this is something from 1986. Well, it turns out it was submitted in 1985. It's actually a reprint of a paper that appeared in 1985 in another journal, but the talk was actually in 1984. So I like to credit 1984 as the year that he came up with this proof. And the way he did this is as follows. He said, well, suppose you have a quantum circuit that's got gates U1 up to U capital T, so that you apply them in order. He said, well, let's write down a Hamiltonian that looks like a sum of terms, each of which applies U sub little t to the data qubits and advances the state of an auxiliary system, which he called the cursor. It'll annihilate the state at t minus 1 and create it at site t. So here's a possible geometry of how you might imagine this laid out. Suppose the data was arranged in a ring, and this cursor was like a line threading the ring here. And so every time each one of these interactions corresponds to some unitary gate that couples two different data qubits, but it's also coupled to the two cursor qubits that advance you from time t to t plus 1. And I suppose in general these unitary transformations would be bigger than two qubits, although we often think about gate bases that involve two or fewer qubit gates. So that was his solution. He wrote this down. He said, okay, well, this Hamiltonian, you know, we need to include the complex conjugate as well. You know, if we want to have this forward propagation in order for this to be Hermitian, we also have to have backward propagation as well. So I guess this is a very Feynman-esque kind of idea, right? He loved to think about electrons bouncing backward and forward in time, things like this. So this is, you know, we have to have this happening in our computation. And how is it that this simulates a quantum algorithm or, a quantum circuit? Well, the first thing to observe is that if we prepare the cursor in a state that's got one spin in the state 1 and all the other ones in the state 0, then evolution by this Hamiltonian will conserve the number of 1s in the cursor state, because all it does is it annihilates it one place and advances it to the next, and it'll either move it forward or backwards. So you sort of stay in this single exciton subspace, if you like. And that means that this Hamiltonian, which ostensibly would have 2 to the n states on the, or 2 to the t, I guess, states on the cursor, really is only a t-state system, because you only ever evolve yourself between t possible orthogonal states, given that you started in a very special initial state that had the cursor with 1 at the beginning and 0 everywhere else. So that means that this Hamiltonian that we started with, we can write down an effective Hamiltonian that just looks like, instead of advancing on a line of t spins, just looks like we have a t-level ladder system, and we're just going up and down on the ladder. There's sort of an effective mapping of that chain to sort of like a, you know, levels of an atom or something like this. And the next thing to note, and this is really Feynman's genius, was that it doesn't matter what set of unitaries you use in this definition of this Hamiltonian. No matter what you use, this Hamiltonian is just a hopping Hamiltonian. It's just a hopping Hamiltonian on a different basis of states, depending on which set of unitaries that you've got. So if you move to a basis for this Hilbert space spanned by this Hamiltonian acts on, that's the superposition of all possible computations up to time little t. Then in that basis, this effective Hamiltonian is just a hopping Hamiltonian that advances you from t minus 1 to t or from t to t minus 1. So it's a very simple Hamiltonian. And in fact, it is a quantum walk on a line, because this Hamiltonian, what are the states of the system? Well, the states, you know, are states 1 through, you know, you can label them 1 through capital T if you like, and the adjacency matrix is just corresponds to the adjacency matrix of a line graph. So in this basis of states, Feynman's Hamiltonian is nothing more than a quantum walk on a line. So it's a very simple graph. You don't even have to think about complicated graphs. As Sagato mentioned, propagation in a one-dimensional chain that has a Hamiltonian like this is, so incidentally, what Sagato talked about was when all these unitaries were the identity matrix, right? Then we just have, it turns out that sigma plus sigma minus plus sigma minus sigma plus is the same as XX plus YY. It's the same Hamiltonian. And so for the, you know, a way to understand this communication issue is that, you know, you're really just doing a quantum walk on a line again in a spin chain. And we can make that perfect fidelity, if we like, through this engineering that he talked about that I worked on. You can actually, if you like, make this simulation of a quantum circuit by a time-independent Hamiltonian exact by just engineering the couplings between the various sites in the spin chain with this particular pattern of root t times t minus little t. And if you do that pattern, then the Hamiltonian will simulate the circuit exactly. So you don't even need the epsilon, even though I mentioned it in the right way to define universality. This is an exact simulation of the quantum circuit. And so this engineering idea is based on work that I did with some folks at Cambridge here. And so there's kind of the cast of characters there. Okay. Well, you know, we've got troubles in graphland. We heard about graphland earlier in this conference. Well, we've got some problems here. The Hamiltonian that Feynman suggested is kind of not very physical. I mean, where are you going to find a Hamiltonian like this? It's kind of out in left field. Well, how bad is this Hamiltonian? Well, let's consider a universal set of gates for a circuit. It's known from like 97. Kataev noted that the gate basis consists of a Hadamard and a controlled phase gate, this thing here. That's a universal gate basis. So without loss of generality, these unitaries are at most 2-qubit gates. And this hopping term is also involves 2 qubits, 2 spins on the line. So these are 4-body interactions. So we need to have a Hamiltonian that's got 4-body interactions in it. That's what Feynman proposed. And they're not spatially local either, because, for example, this is one geometry, but anything you draw is going to have this feature that as the size of the data increases, it gets further and further away from the cursor. You've got one global cursor. It's sitting somewhere. And as the data gets bigger and bigger, it is necessarily getting further away from this cursor. And so you're requiring for a scalable quantum computer to have interactions that are just arbitrarily long distance, which I think is also kind of unphysical. So these are two major problems with Feynman's architecture. And this is what we want to solve with our spin chain model. So what are the key ideas in our solution? Well, the first is that we can throw on the swap gate into the Kataev gate basis. And then we've got a nearest neighbor gate basis that's universal. We can do universal quantum computation just between nearest neighbors in a linear arrangement. We don't have to worry about coupling together like a controlled phase gate between two very distant qubits. Another thing to recognize, and this is why I went through this pattern about programmable quantum circuits, is that by introducing the cursor, what Feynman's actually doing is not simulating the original circuit, but simulating a programmable version of that circuit, because the cursor is just the program. And it tells you at time t, do this gate. At time t plus 1, do this gate. He's added on a program region. Without calling it that, that's what he's done. And so by recognizing that, we can beat down on this program region and try to make it simpler. And so our approach was to give a hierarchical structure to the program region. So instead of just having one giant global program, we divided into a master program that only had a constant size, no matter how big the computation is that you're working with. And that master program controlled a bunch of smaller slave programs whose size did scale with the computation. But the nice thing about that is that then you can take that. So now what used to be this long line here is now maybe a short line for our master program. And you know, relative to the master program, the slave programs are just data to it. So they can be embedded in the ring relative to the master program. And then the last trick is to say, well, the master program doesn't need to be some global point far away. If it's a constant size as the computation grows, we can just embed it in the actual systems themselves. So that's why we moved to spin 8 or 8-level spin systems. So instead of having, you know, some giant clock tower that everybody is, you know, referencing off of, we'll give a pocket watch to everybody, and they can use that to, you know, check what's going on. And so those are sort of the key ideas that we're going to use to practice NUT. So before going through the circuitry that does this, I think it's instructive to do kind of a little animation, if you like, as to how this hierarchy of programs work. So here's a set of three programs that will simulate any circuit over the Kataev gate basis, Well, the one augmented with swap, in fact. So ahead of time, the swap program knows that the first time it gets called, it's supposed to move, it's supposed to use swap operations to move the yellow qubit and the green qubit next to one another over here. So it's supposed to move the yellow qubit into location A and the green qubit into location B, just by local swaps. And the Hadamard program here knows that the first time it gets called, it's supposed to apply a Hadamard to qubit A. And you know, the next time the swap program gets called, it moves another pair of qubits into that location. And that time, the Hadamard program does not apply the Hadamard. So let's see a little animation of how this goes. So the master program says, move the next qubit into position A. So he tells Tweedledee and Tweedledum down here to do that. And so they start swapping. And if you look, I'm just cycling the colors. I've put them in the colors of the rainbow so you can remember the ordering here. But so it cycles it until we get the yellow qubit in A. And they announce, qubit A is in position. We're ready. And then the master program says, move the next qubit into position B. And Tweedledee and Tweedledum do their, they cycle around everything but qubit A. And eventually, the green qubit ends up in B. And then they say, qubit B is in position. And then the master program says, apply the controlled phase gate between qubits A and B. And Hadamard program, do your magic. And so the controlled phase gate gets done between qubits A and B that have been moved into position. And then the Hadamard gate, in this case, his instruction is yes to apply the Hadamard. So he does it on qubit A. And then he says, done. And the whole process repeats over and over. And I hope you can see from this little animation how you'd be able to move any two qubits by these swaps into the positions A and B and apply a controlled phase gate on them and then at will choose to whether or not apply Hadamard to it. This will allow you to do any computation because of a neat little trick. You might think, well, every time this thing goes around, we apply a controlled phase gate. And what if I just wanted to do a single Hadamard? Well, the trick is you just call the, you have the Hadamard program say, to do no Hadamard four times in a row, and it turns out the controlled phase gate, if you apply it four times in a row, is just the identity operation. So you just cycle through this thing four times in a row, and then you call the Hadamard, so you've been able to do the Hadamard at any qubit because you've swapped it there. And we can do the controlled phase gate between any pair of qubits by swapping them into these special locations and not doing the Hadamard. And that's our universal gate basis. So this is how a hierarchy of programs can pull this off. Is this clear? OK, so let me show you this in a circuit model representation, how this is supposed to work. So the program region is actually divided into three separate subprograms. So we've got a cursor program, a swap program, and a Hadamard program. And then there's a data region. And how does this thing work? Well, the first thing that happens in phase one is that we cycle. So capital sigma is my notation for cycling. It'll cycle the top swap qubit all the way down to the bottom. And then if there's a zero there, it's going to cycle the cursor state. It's a two-bit state. I'm going to label those two-bit states by these four different glyphs. It can either be this sort of, I don't know, little circular thing, a circle thing with a dot, an exclamation point, or a dash. So we're going to imagine that the system starts in this state here. The cursor will start in this state. So if there happens to be a zero there, it'll advance to that one. Then what we do is in phase three is we cycle everything but the last data qubit. So this is kind of like what Tweedledee and Tweedledum are doing. They're cycling everything but the last one. And if we're in this circuit cycle phase here, then we also cycle the very last one. Otherwise, if we're not, then we would not cycle the last one. So that's what this little dot is supposed to indicate. You're cycling everything but the last one. And if we happen to be in this gate phase with the exclamation point, then what we do in phase four is to apply our controlled phase gate and then conditionally apply the Hadamard, depending on whether or not the Hadamard program tells us we're supposed to be doing this or not. And then finally, we cycle the Hadamard program bits, so they cycle around as well. And we repeat this whole procedure. The net effect of this is, you know, we start in this cycle phase for the cursor. Then as long as the swap program is containing ones, it's just going to be cycling the data qubit. So it's like that first phase I had in my animation where all the qubits are being cycled around. Then it stops once it sees a zero, and it moves to this phase where it's cycling around everything but the last one, like I had in the animation. And then it gets another zero, and it goes into the gate phase where it does a controlled phase gate, and it does the Hadamard, and it repeats. So this is just the circuit depicting that animation that I talked about before. Just write it down. And notice that it's got this really nice local structure to it, and that the quantum logic seems to always go from the top to the bottom, and always in a local way, except for the talking to the cursor program. That's non-local. It has to reach up far to talk to that. But if we could embed this cursor in all of these data objects here, and it could travel along, and we may put periodic boundary conditions so this touches back up to that again, then we could just cycle around and around and around in this in a local way. So this is kind of giving us by going to this programmable circuit architecture, we're actually able to really put a lot of structure in the circuitry we consider that is going to allow us to do this local interaction business when we go to the Hamiltonian model. So in fact, the way we do this is we take this circuit and we map it onto a spin chain that actually is on a ring. And it'll have three regions, a Hadamard region, a swap region, and a data region. And they're eight-state systems, which we can conceptually decompose into a qubit for where the data is and a four-state system for the cursor. And the cursor is always going to be in a classical state here, but the qubits could be in quantum states as the computation goes on. And so from this set of gates, we can actually write down a set of rules that tell you how you're supposed to advance in this system. You know, you have a gate that moves you forward, so it'll do something to the qubit and advance the cursor to go from one state to another, conditioned on what the bit value is, and so on and so forth. And you have to go forwards and backwards. So we can write down a Hamiltonian very similar to Feynman's, where we've got these gates going forward and gate staggers going backwards. And they're only involved two-body interactions, because this whole thing is just local. So you can write this all down, and even though this is more of a, you know, technical seminar, I think this is really too dry even for this, so I'm not going to go through all these, but you can read our paper if you're interested. You can work out what all of these rules are that tell you how you're supposed to advance and regress. There's one special one that we actually add, and this one in purple here. So let me zoom in on this, and I apologize for the weird animation. I don't know what's going on. I'm trying to fix that this morning, but we add one extra state or two extra terms in our Hamiltonian that enforce a start state and a stop state. Because we're on a ring, what's to say that we won't continue on forever? I mean, you know, just sort of looping around and around and around. Well, we can add in conditions. So if you remember back from the earlier thing that I had, the gate phase always, you did a gate and then you automatically were back to this swap cycle again, the whole thing repeated. So it turns out that in a normal course of computation with a correct preparation, you'll never find yourself in a gate phase over the qubit in the state one here. So we can create that, we can use a projector onto that as kind of like a Garden of Eden state to say, okay, we're, you know, this is a state that we start from, but we'll never regress back beyond. So because there's no quantum logic that would do that. So we have an initial state and we have a terminating state too, a stop state that also never gets reached. So that's going to allow us to unfurl, although the quantum logic is going to go around and around and around in a ring, we'll have a special start state and we'll have a special stop state, which will effectively unfurl this ring into a line. It's going to make it a quantum walk on a line by having these special start and stop states. So we can go through and do like a quantum walk analysis, if you like, on this. And we'll see that if you prepare the initial state of the system in the state psi 0 to describe the program and the data input, that the rules are rigged so that every state psi sub t has a unique successor state. So it will always only go to one place after this. It'll, like, you know, the cursor will advance and a gate will happen between the relevant qubits. And of course, there's a, you know, if you're in the middle of computation, there's a successor state and a predecessor state, but they're unique always. You might ask, well, how big is this ring? This is this efficiency question again. So we need to, if we had a circuit that acted on n qubits and had t gates, we have to pass over our n qubits t times in order to do this. So the size of our swap program and our Hadamard program actually has to be of size order n times t, because it's controlling, you know, what we do every time we pass around this thing. We've got to pass around it that many times. And so we're passing around this ring that's of size order nt spins on both the swap and the Hadamard regions and, you know, n qubits in the data. And we do that for an amount of time equal to the size of the swap and the Hadamard regions. So we have this quadratic total time that we take because we're having to go over a larger space. You know, every time we go around the ring, it's bigger than just the data because it also has to carry through the program that controls the data. And so there's an effective time, t bar, which is order nt squared, which is the amount of time this quantum walk evolves for. And just like Feynman worked out, this set of states, it doesn't depend on the computation, the fact that you have, you know, circuitry going on in here. It just, all that matters is that you have a unique successor and predecessor state for every state that you're in. And so there's an effective Hamiltonian describing this that's a quantum walk on a line once again. We had to add these extra start and stop terminating conditions in order to make our ring Hamiltonian become effectively a line. But that doesn't, and so strictly speaking, this Hamiltonian is slightly different than Feynman's. But it turns out that doesn't actually affect things very much. And you go through the same kind of analysis, and you could ask, well, when are you most likely, given a correct initial preparation of the system, to find yourself having the computation done? And well, if you just wait an amount of time that's t bar over 2, then you have an amplitude for being in the final state of t bar to the minus 1/3. So you could just repeat the computation, order t to the 2/3 times, if you like. You could just prepare your initial state. You know, you could be Homer, and you just wait this amount of time, and you measure. And, you know, maybe it's a solution that you can verify. It's an NP, so you can verify the solution quickly. You know, so are these the factors, yes or no? Maybe he might not be able to do that. But, you know, you send it off to somebody that can verify. So you can repeat this thing a number of times. Or, as Sagato mentioned, there are a number of clever ways you can actually make this thing more efficient. You can do encodings at one end, or you can do conclusive transfer. You know, there's all these kinds of variations. You know, in particular, you could do this engineering of the couplings to make the simulé aberration, I guess, of this unitary exact. I mean, there's a number of different solutions for doing this. Okay, so this is how you were able to use eight state spins on a ring to simulate a universal quantum circuit. But maybe 8 states isn't good enough for you. Maybe you really like qubits. You know, you love qubits. They're your best friend. And, you know, 8 states is just too confusing. Can we do this with qubits? Well, we weren't able to do it with qubits in a one-dimensional ring. That's not to say that you can't do it, although there's evidence to suggest that you probably cannot do it, because there's evidence that you could simulate qubits on a one-dimensional ring efficiently with a classical computer, although there's no actual proof at this point. But if that was proven, then that would be strong evidence that you couldn't get universal quantum computing. But again, even that's not a proof, I guess, until we know that the computational power of classical and quantum computers is different. But we can actually get to, we were able to get to qubits, but by sacrificing dimensions. So we it turns out that if you have a two-body interaction between eight-level systems, well, you can think of these eight-level systems as decomposed into 3 qubits each, right? That Hilbert space is of size 8. In fact, that's even the way I described it when I drew that little picture with the 2 rings and everything like that. But now what used to be a 2-body interaction between the 8-level spins has now become a 6-body interaction between 2-level spins. And now we're back. We're even worse than Feynman, right? I mean, Feynman had 4-body interactions. We said, oh, that's really ridiculous. Now I'm proposing 6-body interactions between qubits. That's like, seems like a step in the wrong direction. But fortunately, there's this beautiful machinery, this gadget perturbation theory that's developed by Kataev and others, where you can actually take a many-body interaction, replace it by a collection of 2-body interactions. You can even make it nearest neighbor interactions on a 2-dimensional grid by this work by Oliveira and Terhal. But you have to go to sixth order perturbation theory to do this. So if you want to make this thing just have 2-body interactions, you can add a number of what are called mediator qubits around and prepare fiducial initial states of them and have couplings between these 6 qubits and the mediator qubits, and maybe even couplings between the mediator qubits themselves. And you rig the strengths of the interactions between the mediator qubits and these qubits so that at sixth order perturbation theory, there's an effective 6-body interaction. So in principle, we have a way to do this with 2-qubit interactions that are nearest neighbor on a 2-dimensional grid. But it's still kind of not so satisfying because we need to have probably outrageous amounts of energy involved to do this. I mean, sixth order perturbation theory is sort of, whew. I mean, you know, I don't see anybody implementing that anytime soon. But at least in principle, we know that you can build a universal quantum computer with qubits on a two-dimensional cylinder. Yes?
Are they all of the same distance as indicated by your triple from the two-body distance?
Yes, in the sense that, I mean, each of these eight spin systems, we really imagine there to be three qubits at that location, and then there's three qubits at the other location. And so in our, if we're trying to mock up a spin chain that's in a line, we just sort of replace as a surrogate three qubits per one.
So what about the vertical? That doesn't convey any distance per se, right?
Not necessarily, no. I mean,
so how do they do the perturbation theory by this theorem that you're saying about time? And what is the perturbation parameter?
So the theory is abstract. It has nothing to do with distances. It just says if you have a k-body interaction, you can simulate a k-body interaction with order k two-body interactions to k-order perturbation theory. And so what happens is that you make the interactions so strong between the physical qubits and the mediator qubits that you can effectively treat this adiabatically, if you like, and say that information just quickly goes. It's so fast that it's as though, you know, if you have Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and Bob, the interaction between Alice and Bob is strong, and the interaction between Bob and Charlie is strong, it can be so fast that it's as though Alice was talking directly to Charlie. And now Bob can talk to other people other than just Alice and Bob, and so you can set up a three-body interaction this way. And it's sort of that
really
idea.
So that it's really a one-body. A level two body. There's a disparity. What I'm saying is that in terms of the purple, the real physical distance versus your virtual space, where you can carry out those three when you do the interaction. That's all I want to.
Yeah, those virtual qubits, there's some massaging that happens in this Oliver and Tahal paper where you work out where the physical layout is of these extra mediator qubits that, you know, that are used to mock up this kind of an interaction. You show you can put it in a planar geometry on a Cartesian grid with nearest neighbor interactions on that grid. So there is a way to physically lay that out. Yeah. Okay, so given the time here, I don't think I'll have time to go into the details of adiabatic quantum computing, so I'll just mention it a little bit. But we solved the problem for a quantum walk computer. And it turns out there's close connections between quantum walks and adiabatic algorithms. They both involve kind of continuous time evolutions, right? So in the adiabatic model, what we do is we prepare the ground state of an initial Hamiltonian. We slowly deform the Hamiltonian. And if we deform it slowly enough, we'll find ourselves in the ground state of the final Hamiltonian. So this is also maybe simple for Homer to do, but he's now got to, like, you know, put his pencil to the screen and trace some sort of a path for the Hamiltonians. So there's still work to do. He doesn't just have to sit back and take a nap. But it's a very simple kind of a control. And, you know, we can be very formal about this, about exactly how much time, how slowly you have to go, and in order for you to find yourself very close to the ground state of the final Hamiltonian. But at the end of the day, as long as this quantity here, the so-called gap, the minimum gap, the separation in energy eigenvalues between the ground state energy and the first excited energy of the Hamiltonians as you're deforming through them, as long as that thing scales only polynomially with the size of the problem you're interested in, then this amount of time will be only polynomial in your problem size. And so the general strategy for getting universal quantum computing with an adiabatic computer is to say that you'd like to have your ground state of H of 0 to be some specified initial state. And usually, this is done not in the programmable circuit model. So we had to do a little bit of extra work to initialize a state for a programmable circuit as opposed to just a circuit where all the inputs are 0, say. And then we want the ground state of the Hamiltonian to be this so-called computation history state, where it's, again, the superposition of all partial computations up to the final time. And as long as the gap remains polynomial when going from this Hamiltonian to this Hamiltonian, then you can argue that you will be able to do universal quantum computing in an adiabatic way as you evolve from one to the other. You just put whatever circuit it is that you want to simulate with the adiabatic algorithm into this definition of this final state. And so at this point, it's standard machinery, and it's been reused a number of times by a number of different groups. And I don't think I have time to go into the details of how we did this, but basically it's you just do a very simple variation on our Hamiltonian, have to add a couple of extra local terms. But at the end of the day, you can use our Hamiltonian to drive universal adiabatic quantum computing as well. So what's the sort of greater context in which this quantum spin chain computer fits? Well, Dominic Jiangxing proved in 2007 that there's a way to do quantum walks with, oops, I forgot to put that there, but he's got it with three nearest neighbor interactions with three state systems on a one-dimensional line. So ours is two state system. I mean, sorry, the three state systems on a two-dimensional cylinder. We've got it down to two state systems on a two-dimensional cylinder, so that's, I guess, one less. There's been some interesting work about not just doing a quantum walk, but what you might call a continuous time quantum cellular automaton, where the Hamiltonian is translationally invariant, so you've got the same rules at every point. This would be even better than what I talked about, right? Because it's even simpler still. The fabricating the Hamiltonian becomes much easier for Professor Frink. It doesn't have to vary, you know, as you go down the chain. And the latest in this effort is, well, you can get down to 10 state systems in a 1D ring. And there's some early work that shows you can also do it with 31 or 30 state systems, but the state of the art is 10 state systems. And if you want to just do the adiabatic universality question, Aharonov, Gottesman, Arani, and Kempa showed you could do it with 9 state systems on a 1D line. And the Hamiltonian that they suggest actually, I think, could be used also for the continuous time quantum walk as well. I don't think there's much you have to do there, too. So. Even though they didn't discuss it in their paper, this same kind of Hamiltonian can be used to build a quantum walk computer as well. And there's this third issue, which I haven't talked about, but which is how hard is it to find the ground state of Hamiltonians? And it turns out that a number of large classes of Hamiltonians have the feature that finding their ground state is a QMA complete problem. It's sort of the NP complete for quantum computers. If you want to do this, the latest and greatest is you can do this with 12 state systems on a one-dimensional line. Again, the same paper by Aharonov et al. Or if you want it to be a, you know, a quantum cellular automaton, we can do it with a translationally invariant Hamiltonian, but we need 43 state systems to do that. We weren't able to take our Hamiltonian and map it into this QMA setting because there's some technical difficulties in this. I can talk with people about that afterwards if you're interested. You might sort of get some appreciation that there are technical difficulties when you see that, you know, it's gone to 43 spins here, but in the same paper by Kay where he's able to use, well, 31 state systems for the cellular automaton itself. So there are a lot of technical things to think about when you go to this QMA setting. So what's the future for this, you know, kind of architecture for quantum computers? Well, maybe we can, I haven't talked about fault tolerance in this model. So only very few models of quantum computing are known to even exhibit a threshold for fault-tolerant quantum computing. And it's unknown whether or not the quantum walk model or the adiabatic model even has a threshold for fault-tolerant quantum computing. And so I think it's important to try to show that such a thing exists because these computational models are so compelling, they're so user-friendly. It would be good to show that they're also robust. This quantum walk model, you can think of as kind of a self-propelling computation, right? There's nothing that the user has to do. It just sort of drives itself. We know there are classes of quantum error-correcting codes that are self-correcting. Unfortunately, they only exist in four spatial dimensions using this toric code thing. But maybe we can get simpler versions of that and put them together and have a computer that's extremely user-friendly that doesn't require very much on the part of the user at all. All you might need to do is have a refrigerator to cool the system to the fact that entropy is being generated when you have noise coming into the system. But the correction itself wouldn't have to be actively done. It would be done by the physics of the system. I think this program hierarchy idea is an interesting new idea of general use that beyond what I've just talked about today. And I think by thinking about different kinds of program hierarchies, I just talked about one, we might be able to come up with new architectures that maybe use fewer states per spin or maybe use it for other kinds of problems as well. I think this whole paradigm of using software to write new programs rather than rewriting the hardware is a useful one for quantum computers. It's what we do for classical computers in everyday practice. So I think we should think about doing that in the quantum case as well. And also, an advantage of thinking about these models is that we might be able to develop new quantum algorithms directly in the model. So, you know, there's been recent advances. For example, the so-called NAND tree algorithm has been implemented directly in the quantum walk model. And we know that you can do spatial quantum search, a variation of Grover's algorithm in this model. We can also do certain maze algorithms. You can walk through them more exponentially, more quickly than classical algorithms could. Maybe we can, you know, think in this model to, rather than trying to go through these universality proofs, you know, develop new algorithms in this quantum walk model. And finally, this 2D construction I talked about has kind of got this unappealing feature that we have to go to sixth order perturbation theory in order to, you know, get it to work. And that's not so good. Maybe we can get it to you know, have a more direct way of getting a two-dimensional model that just uses qubits, because maybe we can imagine implementing it then in a system with, I don't know, quantum dots or optical lattice or whatever, ion traps, what have you. So I think that would be useful as well. And so I think I'll end with credits, and thank you for your time.
Yes. Four short questions, but maybe you answer just the two least annoying questions. One thing is, in the gadget perturbation theory, as far as I know, you have an expensive error in the ground energy if you replace the Hamiltonian by a two-level Hamiltonian. Would that be an obstacle in the error that you make?
Absolutely. So it's you can't use this perturbation theory technique to make error-correcting codes somehow suddenly just two-body, you know, codes. Just like for example, the toric code involves four-body check measurements. You might think, oh, well, I'll just use this, you know, thing and do two-body. But no, it turns out it collapsed. It doesn't work with some of these stability issues. So I think that is not the route to build a robust spin chain computer, is to use this perturbation theory. That's why this is the last thing that we should really think about. A two-dimensional qubit architecture that doesn't need to use the gadget perturbation theory technique. But in one dimension, remember, we didn't need to use it at all. So we don't have to worry about that there.
And you said that there's evidence for simulating qubits, like spin chains, efficiently. What's the evidence?
So there's some work by Tobias Osborne, where he's there's something in the archive which I didn't put up there, which talked about simulating spin chains with qubits in a row. And so,
But that's those that are connected with an adiabatic path to a classical model, specific kinds of things.
Yeah, that's why I call it evidence, not proofs. I mean, yeah, it might be. It might be universal for quantum computers. I don't know. I mean, that's as low as you can go. It would be great if you could do that, but I don't know.
I'm not asking the rest of it.
Okay. Yes?
So, Andrew, I have something very basic. Maybe you can help me. The slide very in the beginning is really the meaning of quantum walk, right? So you're trying to compare. The reason why we use walk is probably from the quantum grounded motion type, right? And you said that it's because you don't remember, right? As a drunkard that's going, you forget about the previous step. But for all closed systems, the quantum dynamics is always Markovian, right? That's why we could, you know, propagate and solve things on the computer.
Right.
So there must be something, you're making some restriction to the quantum dynamics, which you then call quantum walk. What is that?
It's that this Hamiltonian is time independent. So, you know, when we first take quantum mechanics, we learn the time independent Schrodinger equation, and we solve all these problems in physics courses. And then we move on to the more advanced time dependent Schrodinger equation, where the Hamiltonian is allowed to change as a function of time. Mm-hmm. Quantum walk setting is the one in which the Hamiltonian is time independent. It is not allowed to change as a function of time. So, for example, you can't exhibit the adiabatic algorithm in the quantum walk model, because there is a specific example where the Hamiltonian is specifically, the whole way everything happens is just by the Hamiltonian changing as a function of time. So that's the restriction. And an analogous restriction exists in the random walk setting as well. This K matrix is not a function of time, but more generally, the master equation describing the most general linear dynamics of a probabilistic vectors involves a matrix that can change as a function of time. So that's a restriction. That K and H are not functions of time.
Yeah, but you know that even in master equation, of course, you can have all time-dependent coefficients for the evolution. So I guess I'm still missing something. So when you say it's time-independent Hamiltonian, you are trying to find configurations or something rather than dynamics?
So I'm just saying that's what defines a quantum walk. So that means that the way a quantum computer works with this is by tuning the statics. You know, when we think of operating a quantum computer with unitary gates, where, you know, turning on and off Hamiltonians or pulsing interactions, the Hamiltonian is changing as a function of time to make those unitaries happen. Here, you would tune the statics. So you set out, you lay out your spins in a certain way, and you tune the interactions between them in such a way that just evolution by these static couplings will cause kind of like a spin wave to propagate through the system. Uh-huh. And you tune the interaction so that the spin waves balance and reflect in such a way that they interfere with one another to generate the quantum computation that you're interested in. And
under that condition. Yeah. But there's no randomness in it.
No, that's why I don't like the phrase quantum random walk. I recommend everybody not use that word, that expression, that it's not, because there's nothing random to a quantum walk. It's that's why I put this picture up here. I guess I didn't explain it, but the long-time behavior of a random walk will take a delta function of the origin to a Gaussian distribution. That's well known. Well, the long-time evolution of a continuous-time quantum walk in a line, it's oscillatory, right? We have this phase here, I, and so it causes these wiggles to happen, and it actually spreads out further, and you get this bimodal distribution. So it's a very different behavior, and there's nothing random about the quantum one at all. So it's just a quantum walk, not a quantum
even
random.
Even the walk, the word walk, misconstrued.
Okay. Let's thank Andrew again for a great talk. Back here at 10 past 11.